Australia's famous for some of the best wool in the world. However, even though we produce one quarter of the world's wool, 98% of it is exported before it's turned into clothing. The lack of milling, weaving, and knitting capacity in Australia means that very little knitwear is actually made here. But this wasn't always the case. What are small manufacturers doing to reinvigorate the Australian knitwear industry? Hello and welcome to the Critical Fashion Studies podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Harriet Richards. I'm a lecturer in the School of Fashion and Textiles at RMIT University and co-founder of the Critical Fashion Studies Research Group. Today, I'm talking to Kiri Mae Sampson, co-founder of Hatch and Make, a circular design, development and manufacturing facility producing premium knitwear in Victoria's Yarra Valley. Hatch and Make is innovative both in its implementation of a circular economy framework, which ensures as little waste as possible, and its commitment to local, regenerative production techniques. Before we get started, I'd like to acknowledge that this episode was recorded on the unceded lands of the Woiwurrung and Boomerang language groups of the Eastern Kulin Nation. We pay our deep respect to First Nations elders past and present, and to any Indigenous listeners tuning in. Hi, Kiri Mae. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you launched Hatch and Make in 2021 with two co-founders. Can you start off by telling us a little bit about the business and explain why you chose a circular economy approach rather than a more traditional linear approach?
Yes. So Dave Giles Kay, Nigel Whelan and myself are the co-founders. Hatch and Make is a design, development and manufacturing partner for premium knitwear. We're based in the Yarra Valley with our pilot factory set up, which is a small, lean sort of operation as a starting point. And it's really grounded in all of the values and framework around circular economy and sustainability. I don't think that there's one unanimous definition of what circular economy is and what sustainability is. I think there's lots of different ways that businesses will kind of build metrics around that. So for us, though, I feel like we are working to emulate natural systems, natural environmental systems. So we definitely consider Ellen MacArthur Foundation's three principles. So looking at designing out waste, looking at circulating products and keeping them in the system for as long as possible, and looking at regenerating natural environments. And I think as well, looking at creating product, if you're going to be creating new product, in a way that isn't detrimental to our natural environment. Mm-hmm. So best case scenario as well is that it's not even a neutral situation, but it's beneficial. And that's when we start to look at the opportunities for regenerative wool and things like this. So how can this system that we're a part of have a positive impact on our natural environment? And that's sort of how we take circularity and what we try to apply to all of the decision making. And in terms of why, I think looking at our backgrounds, it was really the only choice. Dave and I in particular, we've kind of come to it separately with our own sort of origin stories on why we thought something like this would be a really good idea. We'd spent years prior, I guess, independently developing our expertise around sustainability and circular economy and textiles and fashion and our experience within the industry. So I think when you mix the recipe of the three of us together and we pulled Nige in along the way as well, it just made sense that this was going to be the way that we would set it up.
Yeah, cool. I might ask you a bit more about the details of the facility in a little bit. But first of all, can you tell me a little bit more about that origin story of where you've come from in the industry that's led you to this point of starting Hatch and Make?
Yeah, bit of a meandering pathway. Yeah. So my background pre-fashion and textiles was in education, which I did for a number of years. And when I decided to sort of make the jump into fashion and textiles, I did a master's at RMIT, which is now, I think, called the Masters of Fashion Entrepreneurship.
Yep,
there. Which was really great in terms of wanting to shift industries and kind of fine tune. I think I'd always had a really soft spot for fashion and textiles, but didn't really identify with the churn and burn nature of the industry. I was only ever going to sort of focus on the sustainability issues and that side of things. So I shaped my whole master's program around those issues. At a time, I would say, when that was kind of a bit of an outlier approach. And, you know, talking about inverted commas, sustainability in fashion would, I guess, just conjure up images of Hessian sack dresses and that's about it. Obviously, we know it's much, much more than that. Yes. But yeah, so that was the time. And then I sort of launched into anything that I could do, said yes to every little opportunity. So I worked a lot in, spent some time sort of in retail and pre-loved kind of retail, secondhand, looking at textile waste management. And that's where I sort of cut my teeth in project management, got into some education as well. I think coming back to the fact that that was my previous qualification and where my interests were, it felt really good to kind of marry those two, fashion and the education and sustainability as well. So did a bit of course development and lecturing and tutoring at different institutes across Melbourne. And then fell into knitwear, which was really beautiful. Spent some time manufacturing, and that was my first real exposure to creating new product. And I guess that kind of sparked the fire for me and continued my work in other areas. I landed in the Australian Fashion Council for a number of years, which was actually, reflecting on it, such an incredible opportunity and such a unique role in the industry to be able to work alongside businesses ranging from sole trader, micro, through to the absolute major players in the country on all sorts of issues and challenges and milestones and everything, and just get to connect with these businesses and individuals in a really non-competitive space as the Australian Fashion Council, in a space that's, we want to help you thrive and how can we do that and how can we be of service to you. So part of my portfolio there was around sustainability. So a really good opportunity to get a really deep understanding of the landscape and the issues and where we're up to, and also some ideas of where we could go. So that was my sort of introduction, I guess. And then, yeah, come 2020, 2021, we decided to set it up.
Amazing. That's like a fantastic meandering journey.
Such a messy one, but yeah.
No, I like it. And it's really interesting to think about how those elements fit together, the interest in education and in sustainability and kind of that macro level approach as well at the AFC, and then to come back to knitwear as well. And one of the things I'm really interested in is the amount of wool that's produced in this country, but how much of it then goes offshore. So I think it's so exciting that you've started this facility that's really bringing some of that manufacturing back to the local environment. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your knitwear expertise and why knitwear is important to you and how this has kind of affected your approach at Hatchmake as well.
And like wool specifically.
Yeah.
We're really focused on wool. We love it. We think it's underutilized.
Yes, I agree.
And has such great potential. Yeah, I think you have some stats too around how much Australia produces on a global scale when it comes to wool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's about a quarter of all the world's wool is produced in Australia.
Yeah, and I reckon if you were to kind of segment that to look at premium wool.
Yes.
It would be a higher
garments. Yes,
proportion again.
And it's some of the very best garment manufacturing wool comes from Australia and New Zealand.
And back to Australia.
Exactly. I know, because we love it here as well.
I don't often hold stats in my head, but there's a few that rattle around. And one of them was like 2016-17, our export of wool tops was like 3.6 billion.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And we did some maths. This was in work that I've done with Alicia McCallion and Dave.
Okay. Yep.
And we've written a couple of articles, but like we were looking at the value of wool and the lack of value add locally, and how, you know, that 2016-17 stat of $3.6 billion worth of wool was exported. What could have been the value of that if we had more processing locally, and if we were to process as far as a commercial yarn, so all the kind of scouring and spinning to do that locally, it was something like 3.5 times the value. So it's like $12 billion or something. But then if we could capture 100% of that 3.6 billion and process it all the way to a garment, it was something like 12 times.
Oh my gosh.
Something like $100 billion worth of economic value that it could bring. And it just seems so... It just doesn't make sense that we don't do more here. And I guess that was part of our motivating factor as well, as we produce such beautiful fibre, and there's so much opportunity to do more with it here. So where could we kind of inject ourselves to have some impact on that? And obviously Hadjamaik is, we're small, we're very small, but how amazing to have it as a, I guess, proof of concept of a way of working within the circular framework that can also help to build capacity, build skills and impact the local whole value chain here. Yeah. One day, that would be incredible.
Exactly.
Yeah, for sure.
So in order to talk through some of the nitty-gritty of what you do, I thought maybe we could use an example of a recent collaboration that you worked on, specifically the Gorgeous Dancing Daisies blanket made from 100% non-mulesed merino wool, which was produced with Seljak brand. Yeah. So if we start from the very beginning, how do you commence a project like that, starting to make a blanket from scratch?
Just daydreams and cups of tea in the Yarra Valley. No. So Sam and Karina, we've been working with pretty much for the extent of the time Hatchimake has been operating now, which is so lovely. And the Dancing Daisies blanket was the first piece out into market with them, which we're so happy with. It's such a beautiful blanket. Yeah, so the process, I guess, we start with a partnership agreement. So we go into working with all of our brand partners and labels and designers as a real partnership, noting that most of the businesses and individuals that we're working with are coming to us with pretty limited experience in knit, which is just the nature of what we have locally access to, I guess. But we love that because we love helping with the design process and everything like that. So we have a partnership agreement that just really outlines from the get-go, I guess, what all of our values and priorities are. So that ticks off everything in relation to how we want to work within the circular framework. But it also notes like all the expertise that both the partner and ourselves will bring to this whole process. And it gives an opportunity for everybody to kind of self-identify that, I guess. And once that's all locked off and we're starting on the same page, then we can move into the really fun stuff. So we love for our brand partners to come and visit the studio. It gives us an opportunity to take them through a bit of an introductory workshop on all of the technologies so they can see how the machine runs and what it's capable of, all of the other bits of machinery that we operate in the space as well. They can jump on and have a go at the linker, dig through our swatch box and, you know, be able to touch and feel. It's such a tactile thing. So anytime we're able to have at least an initial face-to-face consult is just really great. And so Sam and Karina came down to the Yarra Valley and spent a couple of days on site working through their design concepts and everything like that. So we go through the workshop, all the introductory things, and then we hear all of their ideas on what they want to do. And some will come to us with a spec pack ready to go, but some will just come with a broad idea of like, we want to do a blanket, but let's have a look at what the machine's capable of and let that inspire the design. And it was a little bit of both. So Karina and Sam came with this beautiful graphic of the Dancing Daisies, which is so lovely, in this six colour colourway. So then it's a process of, I guess, marrying those ideal design elements with the optimum kind of efficiencies that the machine will work within as well. And we do that working alongside our programmer, who is an incredibly skilled individual, Paul Montgomery, who we work with. And I'm kind of the bridge, I guess, between our label partners and our programmer, Paul, who takes these visual designs and turns them into code, essentially, that the machine can knit. One of the examples of a little challenge that we had to figure out was this six color design. The machine that we're working with, Optimum, really is kind of a three color to be a really efficient knit. So that just meant manipulating the design a little bit. So if you look at the final image, it's still six colours, but you can see if you look really closely across any horizontal cross-section, it's only three at a time.
Oh, how fascinating.
Yeah, and which actually on the backside, which there's photos you can see on their website as well, it gives this beautiful shifting in colours and tones on the back of the blanket as well, which has a whole other, I guess, graphic quality to it as well. So, yeah, little things like that come up in the process. So that's all through the design. Parallel to all of that, we are talking about material inputs. So what we're going to use to actually make the blanket. Some of the sampling we'll do with yarn that we have on hand in the studio, sample yarn, and then we'll look at what they're going to use for production yarn. So then we looked at what the virgin options are and went with non-mules. It also is yarn that has all the checks and balances around chemical input. So it's Blue Sign approved, which they're testing at end of life at the moment as well, which is...
Yes, I was going to ask you a bit about that.
Yeah, we can talk about that. So going through that whole process of what all the material inputs are going to be is part of working together with the brands as well. And for Celljack, that also meant getting new labels made up that were 100% sort of bio-based labels so that they will break down alongside the piece itself at such time as it is past its usable life.
Yeah, in about 150 years,
that's
hopefully.
Right. That's right.
It's been through multiple babies. And,
yep. Yeah. Exactly. Very, very end of the line.
Yeah, exactly. So when you talk about figuring out what yarns are available on the market and you chose to go with 100% non-mulesed wool, what are the other options available at the moment in Australia for virgin wool? Like when you're thinking about doing something as sustainably as possible but not being able to use recycled wool, are there other options?
Typically, your cheapest options are going to be synthetics. But if you want to look at wool, the next cheapest option is going to be something that has no accreditations or certifications or verifications with it. So it's this real like decision-making process on what the priorities are and what does the best look like for all of us. So we source wool that is certified RWS. RWS is the Responsible Wool Standard, which ensures the five freedoms, which is just all about the well-being of the animals on the farm, and includes non-mulesed. So mulesing is a process that good intent to protect flocks from fly strike, which is a horrible thing for an animal to go through in itself, but has historically and broadly had some very questionable practices associated with it. It's basically mulesing is the process of removing the skin folds around the tail and anus of the sheep to protect it, but often that has been done in very cruel ways that don't involve caring for the well-being of the animal. So certified non-mules make sure that the wool is coming from farms where that doesn't happen. I do think it's worth noting that it's complicated. There are farmers, particularly in Australia, who have the utmost care for their flocks, who do mules, who do it in a more humane way where they're using pain relief for the animal and taking care of their well-being in the process, but they're farming in areas that are particularly susceptible to fly strike and things like this. So as with anything, it is complicated, but we have made the commitment to use non-mulesed wool.
Yeah. And if you think about getting to an even better standard, I think you're looking into using wool from regenerative farms.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's the next step for us. And I know Celljack are really keen to follow that pathway with us as well. And cherry on top would be Australian regenerative. So if we could source as much as possible locally, and we're looking into whether there are any kind of micro spinning capabilities that would suit our machine, because all spinning, like there are some spinners around, ones that we know of predominantly are focused on woolen processes, which is more for wovens.
Okay.
So it's a different process that requires different specs and different apparatus, I guess, machinery to create it. So it's really limited for our application to have things run locally, but we're still looking into options and people who might like to test it out.
Oh, exciting. And so going back to your point about the documentation that Sam and Karina at Celljack have been doing about composting the blanket at its potential end of life and hopefully decades and decades into the future, that really comes back to these questions about circularity.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
So working with partners as well who hold those values in mind as well. So I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about that process and also, you know, how those decisions about garment end of life or blanket end of life play into the design decisions you're making at the beginning.
Firstly, incredible that they are doing that.
Amazing.
Just totally off their own backs. Like, I just think that's such a gold star standard for a brand to be testing those things on their own, because we go with the information that we have. And I have, in the processes of building Hatch and Make and sourcing yarns and things like this, interrogated these certifications and questioned from all the way back to our suppliers and you know, oh, that's a lab question, we'll pass it on and come back to you kind of answers around the blue sign, you know, where they're certifying the safety of all the chemical inputs. And so my questions have been around what testing's been done on end of life for that. Can you say that it's safe if it goes into the ground? Can we grow our food in it afterwards? And they just don't, it's not been tested.
Oh, really?
So they can test based on what they know about the chemicals and its impact on humans and things like that. But the tests, the literature's not there yet to say at end of life, these are the outcomes. So it's super interesting that in 2023, when we know as much as we do, that the suppliers at the beginning aren't able to answer questions about what's happening at the end. And maybe that's, I don't know, people, not enough people are asking or whatever the case. But so it is absolutely incredible that Sam and Karina are just like doing that on their own. And they'll be providing such important information when they come to the end of that process as well, that they'll share and will help inform decisions other partners might make as well about the inputs that we choose.
So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the facility, the hatch and make facility.
Yeah.
So if we're thinking about these circularity questions, I mean, asking questions to your wool suppliers about, you know, the certifications of that yarn, but also when I've spoken to you previously and you talked about how the facility is solar and rainwater run and someone said it's not possible and you were like, we'll show you. So I wonder, I mean, that's really taking the challenging approach,
but
really staying true to those values of circularity that you started with.
Yeah. So I think the studios run on solar and rainwater, tank water, as you said. The thing that we had pushed back on about was the tank water. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the key things you try to do in manufacturing and any kind of repetitive production is limit variables, and so that you can keep getting, you know, consistent outcomes. So I think for the people who had questions around the rainwater, it was around it being a variable input, and we do wet processing of the pieces. So we use it on the garments and on the blankets and everything that we process. But it's kind of one of those things, and you see this so much where they're like, oh, no, you can't. And you're like, but did anyone try?
Exactly. Just because it's always been done that way doesn't mean it has to continue always being done that way.
Exactly. So we have successfully been using rainwater for a year and a half, 2 years now, and are getting consistent results in our product, and it's been totally fine. So that's a happy story. And also, like, that's the freedom of setting something up, and also setting something up that's starting quite small, that it's a testing ground. And, you know, we also have been really fortunate, we were talking about it earlier, to have support from Creative Victoria to be able to test this model and refine this model in you know, the last year or two. So it's a very opportunistic time for us to figure all of this out.
I wonder too about that. I mean, you know, having a small business means that you're agile, you can experiment, you can adapt. But obviously there's also, I guess, a business demand to maybe scale up in the future, you know, that question about scaling up seems to be a prominent one for all small businesses.
Does it scale?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure you get that question
a
lot.
We do, yeah.
So how does that factor into what you do?
It factors.
Yeah.
We talk about it often, the three business partners, just checking in always, being like, we're still on the same page with this, because we do get asked about it. And you know, an element of it is there's those economic imperatives and making sure that we are financially sustainable as a business. But I think we are all so committed to the framework that we're building and the values that underlie it, that we're sure that, yes, we will grow. Yes, it can grow. But we're only going to do it slowly. And so long as we're maintaining that sustainability in every facet that it needs to be a successful business as well. So the beauty of the technology is with the Stole machine and with knitting machines now is that they are quite scalable. We have one machine that we're operating. One person can operate numerous machines. So it's not out of the question that we could hugely increase our output by purchasing more machines without having to scale up our staffing or anything like that necessarily. So from that perspective, yes, it's totally scalable, mm-hmm. but we will continue to move slowly and consciously and responsibly.
Yes, which very much yeah. matches the values
exactly.
of the business.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
So this approach, I also imagine, is not without its challenges, and you've mentioned a couple of those challenges already, but maybe you could share a few more of those challenges. And I know when we've spoken in the past, you've talked a little bit about, you know, learning to use the linking machine, for instance, and being like, how do I do this?
Yeah, so one of the big parts of this is we don't have a massive knitwear industry in Australia anymore, which is, we've already discussed,
yes.
doesn't make a lot of sense to us. So what that means is there's skills shortages and there's gaps, and that's true for industry across mm-hmm. the board. We know that. So in setting this up, there was always going to be some gaps that we would need to fill ourselves. Not only are some of these skills missing, but there's nowhere to learn them either.
Right.
So linking is one of them. Linking is done on a machine called a linker, but it's also a hugely manual task. Someone has to run it. It is incredibly detailed. You are literally looking at a dial with thousands of points on it that little loops need to go on.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, linking was a real challenge. So I did a fellowship. So through the ISSI, the International Specialized Skills Institute, which I highly recommend to anybody who's trying to fill gaps and shortages with skills that exist offshore somewhere. They have great programs that can sometimes, depending on the circumstances, support you to travel to learn a skill, bring it back, with the whole premise being that you will then disseminate that skill
wow.
and share it. And that fits so beautifully with what we want to do with Hatch and Make, building capability and capacity and skills as well. So I took on the fellowship, which I've not finished yet.
Did you have to travel?
So it was really interesting because it was during lockdown and I just had a baby.
Okay. So,
or
a couple of obstacles.
There was a few obstacles. Yeah. There was a lot happening. But I basically proposed it in my application that I would engage with skilled individuals offshore remotely to learn it. And that meant that we needed to invest in a linker before we'd properly set up anything else. So the first machine we had actually was a linker.
Which no one knew what to do with.
Which actually just came to my house because it was locked down.
Of course.
And I just had that in my office next to my desk. So I built essentially this little course for myself in collaboration with the offshore partner. So Knitwear Lab is who we predominantly partnered with for that work, based in the Netherlands. And yeah, so we did lots of Zoom sessions, a couple of pre-recorded little videos that they'd send through. And then we'd have a scheduled time coming together where I'd ask them any questions. And yeah, so that was hugely beneficial and helpful for us to fill this gap. I think I was also mentioning fully fashioned and what that means and why we even need a linker.
Yes.
So fully fashioned is the kind of knitwear that we produce, and what that means is the machine will knit off the exact shape that is required and pieces to scale for a jumper. So for example, with a jumper, you'll get a front piece, a back piece, two sleeves and a neck trim.
Mm-hmm.
And then those pieces need to be assembled, and that happens on the linker.
Right. And that's for zero waste.
That's for zero waste. Well, I don't like to call it zero waste.
Okay.
I like to say minimal waste. It cuts out a lot of waste, not being just knitting yardage and cut and sew, right?
Mm-hmm.
But to get through the machine, there's a small, small, tiny amount of what is actually called waste yarn.
Okay.
that helps it grab hold of it and feed it through the machine. It's a really small amount, and we don't put any in the bin. We stockpile and then we send to be recycled. It's also something that typically businesses will use a synthetic because it's cheap and it's not
right.
part of the garment.
Yeah.
We use 100% cotton for our waste yarn,
mm-hmm.
which is just another decision we've made along the way to limit synthetics and waste.
Yeah, amazing. There's these quite significant challenges that you're facing, but you are also obviously very committed to the goals of the business, the values of the business. So what is it that keeps you inspired?
Probably the partnerships and working with the brands and also like this it's a test in a way, isn't it? Like to just be like, this is our pipe dream. Can we actually do it? And so far, so good.
Yeah. So that kind of
I find
the
that
challenge
really exciting.
In yeah. and of itself is yeah. part of the inspiration.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
That makes sense.
But I also, it's been so refreshing. Like we, you know, part of our partnership agreement as well is this commitment to natural fibers, but that goes as far as the components as well. So if we're doing a garment that has buttons on it, if we're doing a garment that has embroidery or stitching on it, like we are committing to natural fibers for those things as well. Anything that kind of optimizes the end of life opportunity for these pieces. And I've been so pleasantly surprised by the partners that we're working with who maybe have not used the or thought about all of this detail previously, but are just so on board with it. So that is very inspiring also to be like, we're not just totally pushing against a rock.
Yeah.
You know, like people want to do this. They want these options available to them. And maybe that's part of the problem is that historically manufacturers with this underlying framework are not readily available.
So they haven't even necessarily thought about these options in the first instance. So
yeah.
the great opportunities that can come from a partnership like
exactly,
this.
Exactly. Yeah. And we know collaboration is necessary.
Exactly. Absolutely.
So being able to participate in that is just very cool.
Awesome. So finally, what's next for Hatch and Make? Are there any new projects on the horizon that you can share with us?
What's next? I mean, probably a little pat on the backs for getting through our first full winter production season in the next few months, which has been lots of learning and challenges and lots of wins as well. Also, part of this process is realizing things perhaps that we didn't think of from the beginning that we now are figuring out. So one of those is what do we do with the waste that we accumulate through the sampling process or anything like that? So we've now built that into our partnership agreement that we will work with our partners to come to a decision that has best environmental considerations with what to do with that waste and aligns with all the values and bits and pieces like that. So we're looking at bringing together in partnership with the brands that we've worked with, like an annual open house situation where we invite people out and we will sell these products that are not quite perfect, but lovely all the same, you know, maybe not to spec, maybe the sleeve is a centimeter too long or something like that. So perfectly fine, beautiful garments that normally wouldn't see the light of day. We're once again just working to ensure that they don't end up in landfill and what's the best pathway for them to ensure that they're loved. And again, so great. All of our brand partners so far are on board to have their names associated with it as well. So really cool. That's probably the next step, figuring that out. And yeah, just navigating when it's time to move from our beautiful little Yarra Valley studio, where we go and what that looks like.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, some more challenges ahead, but also some really exciting things.
Yeah,
exactly. Well, that sale sounds amazing too. So I'm going to be keeping my eye out for
that. Yes, I will let you know.
Awesome. Thank you, Kerry May, for joining us today. It's been so brilliant to hear more about Hatch and Make and the future of circular knitwear in Australia. I, for one, am very excited to see where the industry can take the innovations you are pioneering. To all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. If you're interested in the work of Hatch and Make, you can visit their website or follow them on Instagram. You can also buy the beautiful Dancing Daisies blanket made at the Hatch and Make studio via Seljak brand. We'll include all of those links in our show notes. This is the final episode of Season 2 of the Critical Fashion Studies podcast. Thank you so much for joining us for this celebration of the vibrant fashion community in Victoria. It's been a joy to share these conversations with you. Thank you also, as ever, to Creative Victoria for their generous support of this season. Thomas Phillips for audio engineering and co-production. Sanam Goodman for social media expertise, and Hugh Caldwell-Ross for our logo. Do keep an eye on your podcast app and follow us on Instagram for details of our work and news of Season 3 coming in the new year, when we'll be bringing you plenty more stories of amazing Australian fashion. See you next time.